Cassette 6, Side 2. So the Metanats were losing their workers en masse. They couldn't imprison them, it was getting hard to scare them. The only way they could keep them was to institute the same sorts of programs that Praxis had started. And this they were doing, or so they said. Maya was sure they were instituting superficial changes meant to resemble Praxis's only in order to keep their workers and their profits, too. But it was possible that Sachs was right, and that they would be unable to keep control of the situation and would usher in a new order despite themselves. Which is what Nergal decided to say during one of his chances to speak in a press conference in a big side room of the Bundeshaus. Standing at the podium, looking out at a room full of reporters and delegates, so unlike the improvised table in the Pavonis warehouse, so unlike the compound hacked out of the jungle in Trinidad, so unlike the stage in the sea of people during that wild night in Burroughs, Nergal saw suddenly that his role was to be the young Martian, the voice of the new world. He could leave being reasonable to Maya and Sachs and provide the alien point of view. "It's going to be all right," he said, looking at as many of them as he could. "Every moment in history contains a mix of archaic elements, things from all over the past, right back into prehistory itself. The present is always a melange of these variously archaic elements. There are still knights coming through on horseback and taking the crops of peasants. There are still guilds and tribes. Now we see so many people leaving their jobs to work in the flood relief efforts. That's a new thing, but it's also a pilgrimage. They want to be pilgrims. They want to have a spiritual purpose. They want to do real work, meaningful work. They won't tolerate being stolen from anymore. Those of you here who represent the aristocracy look worried. Perhaps you will have to work for yourselves and live off that. Live at the same level as anyone else. And it's true. That will happen. But it's going to be all right, even for you. Enough is as good as a feast, and it's when everyone is equal that your kids are safest. This universal distribution of the longevity treatment that we are now seeing is the ultimate meaning of the democratic movement. It's the physical manifestation of democracy here at last. Health for all. And when that happens, the explosion of positive human energy is going to transform the Earth in just a matter of years." Someone in the crowd stood and asked him about the possibility of a population explosion, and he nodded. "Yes, of course, this is a real problem. You don't have to be a demographer to see that if new ones continue being born while the elderly are not dying, population will quickly soar to incredible levels, unsustainable levels, until there will be a crash. So, this has to be faced now. The birth rate simply has to be cut, at least for a while. It isn't a situation that has to last forever. The longevity treatments are not immortality treatments. Eventually, the first generations given the treatment will die, and therein lies the solution to the problem. Say the current population on the two worlds is 15 billion. That means we're already starting from a bad spot. Given the severity of the problem, as long as you get to be a parent at all, there is no reason to complain. It's your own longevity causing the problem, after all, and parenthood is parenthood, one child or 10. So say that each person partners and the two parents have only a single child, so that there is one child for every two people in the previous generation. Say that means 7.5 billion children out of this present generation. And they are all given the longevity treatment too, of course, and cosseted until they are no doubt the insufferable royalty of the world. And they go on to have 4 billion children, the new royalty, and that generation has 2, and so on. All of them are alive at once, and the population is rising all the time, but at a lower rate as time passes. And then at some point, maybe 100 years from now, maybe 1,000 years from now, that first generation will die. It may happen over a fairly short period of time, but fast or slow, when the process is done, the overall population will be almost halved. At that point, people can look at the situation, the infrastructure, the environments of the two worlds, the carrying capacity of the entire solar system, whatever that may be. After the biggest generations are gone, people can start having 2 children each, perhaps, so that there is replacement and a steady state, or whatever. When they have that kind of a choice, the population crisis will be over. It could take 1,000 years. Nergal stopped to look outside of himself, to stare around at the audience, people watching him rapt, silent. He gestured with a hand to draw them all together. In the meantime, we have to help each other. We have to regulate ourselves. We have to take care of the land. And it's here, in this part of the project, that Mars can help Earth. First, we are an experiment in taking care of the land. Everyone learns from that, and some lessons can be applied here. Then, more importantly, though most of the population will always be located here on Earth, a goodly fraction of it can move to Mars. It will help ease the situation, and we'll be happy to take them. We have an obligation to take on as many people as we possibly can, because we on Mars are Terrans still, and we are all in this together. Earth and Mars. And there are other habitable worlds in the solar system as well, not as big as our 2, but there are a lot of them. And by using them all and cooperating, we can get through the populated years and walk out into a golden age. That day's talk made quite an impression as far as one could tell from within the eye of the media storm. Nergal conversed for hours every day after that, with group after group, elaborating the ideas he had first expressed in that meeting. It was exhausting work, and after a few weeks of it without any let-up, he looked out his bedroom window one cloudless morning and went out and talked to his escort about making an expedition. And the escort agreed to tell the people in Bern he was touring privately, and they took a train up into the Alps. The train ran south from Bern, past a long blue lake called the Thuner See, which was flanked by steep grassy Alps and ramparts and spires of gray granite. The lakeside towns were topped by slate-roofed tiles, dominated by ancient trees and an occasional castle. Everything in perfect repair. The vast green pastures between the towns were dotted by big wooden farmhouses with red carnations in flower boxes at every window and balcony. It was a style that hadn't changed in 500 years, the escorts told him. Settling into the land, as if natural to it, the green Alps had been cleared of trees and stones. In their original state, they had been forests. So they were terraformed spaces, huge hilly lawns that had been created to provide forage for cattle. Such an agriculture hadn't made economic sense as capitalism defined it, but the Swiss had supported the high farms anyway because they thought it was important or beautiful or both at once. It was Swiss. There are values higher than economic values, Vlad had insisted back in the Congress on Mars, and Nergal saw now how there were people on Earth who had always believed that, at least in part. Werteswandel, they were saying down in Bern, mutation of values. But it could as well be evolution of values, return of values. Gradual change rather than punctuated equilibrium. Benevolent residual archaisms which endured and endured, until slowly these high isolated mountain valleys had taught the world how to live, their big farmhouses floating by on green waves. A shaft of yellow sun split the clouds and struck the hill behind one such farm, and the Alp gleamed in an emerald mass so intensely green that Nergal felt disoriented, then actually dizzy. It was hard to focus on such a radiant green. The heraldic hill disappeared. Others appeared in the window, wave after green wave, luminous with their own reality. At the town of Interlaken, the train turned and began to ascend a valley so steep that in places the tracks entered tunnels into the rocky sides of the valley and spiraled a full 360 degrees inside the mountain before coming back out into the sun. The head of the train right above the tail. The train ran on tracks rather than pistes because the Swiss had not been convinced that the new technology was enough of an improvement to justify replacing what they already had. And so the train vibrated and even rocked side to side as it rumbled and squealed uphill, steel on steel. They stopped in Grindelwald, and in the station Nergal followed his escort onto a much smaller train which led them up and under the immense north wall of the Eiger. Underneath this wall of stone it appeared only a few hundred meters tall. Nergal had gotten a better sense of its great height 50 kilometers away in Byrne's Monster. Now here he waited patiently as the little train hummed into a tunnel in the mountain itself and began to make its spirals and switchbacks in the darkness, punctuated only by the interior lights of the train and the brief light from a single side tunnel. His escort, about 10 men strong, spoke among themselves in low, guttural Swiss German. When they emerged into the light again, they were in a little station called the Jungfraujoch, the highest train station in Europe, as a sign in 6 languages said. And no wonder, as it was located in an icy pass between the 2 great peaks, the Munk and the Jungfrau, at 3,454 meters above sea level, with no point or destination but its own. Nergal got off the train, trailed by his escort, and went out of the station onto a narrow terrace outside the building. The air was thin, clean, crisp, about 270 km. The best air Nergal had breathed since he left Mars. It brought tears to his eyes, it felt so familiar. Ah, now this was a place. Even with sunglasses on, the light was extremely bright. The sky was a dark cobalt. Snow covered most of the mountainsides, but granite thrust through the snow everywhere, especially on the north sides of the great masses where the cliffs were too steep to hold snow. Up here the Alps no longer resembled an escarpment at all. Each mass of rock had its own look and presence, separated from the rest by deep expanses of empty air, including the glacial valleys that were enormously deep U-gaps. To the north these macro-trenches were very far below and green, or even filled with lakes. To the south, however, they were high and filled only with snow and ice and rock. On this day the wind was pouring up from this south side, bringing the chill of the ice with it. Down the ice valley, directly south of the pass, Nergal could see a huge crumpled white plateau where glaciers poured in from the surrounding high basins to meet in a great confluence. This was Concordia Platz, they told him. 4 big glaciers met, then poured south in the Grosser Aletschgletscher, the longest glacier in Switzerland. Nergal moved down the terrace to its end to see farther into this wilderness of ice. At the far end he found that there was a staircase trail hacked into the hard snow of the south wall where it rose to the pass. It was a path down to the glacier below them, and from there to Concordia Platz. Nergal asked his escorts to stay in the station and wait for him. He wanted to hike alone. They protested, but the glacier in summer was free of snow, the crevasses all obvious, and the trail well clear of them. And no one else was down there on this cold summer day. Nevertheless, the members of the escort were uncertain, and 2 insisted on coming with him at least part way and at a distance behind, just in case. Finally, Nergal nodded at the compromise and pulled on his hood and hiked down the ice stairs, thumping down painfully until he was on the flatter expanse of the Jungfrau Fern. The ridges that walled the snow valley ran south from the Jungfrau and the Munk respectively, then, after a few high kilometers, dropped abruptly to Concordia Platz. From the trail, their rock looked black, perhaps in contrast to the whiteness of the snow. Here and there were patches of faint pinkness in the white snow. Algae. Life even here, but barely. It was for the most part a pure expanse of white and black, and the overarching dome of Prussian blue, with a cold wind funneling up the canyon from Concordia Platz. He wanted to make it down to Concordia Platz and have a look around, but he couldn't tell whether the day would give him enough time or not. It was very difficult to judge how far away things were. It could easily have been farther than it looked. But he could go until the sun was halfway to the western horizon and then turn back, and so he hiked swiftly downhill over the fern, from orange wand to orange wand, feeling the extra person inside him, feeling also the two members of the escort who were tagging along some 200 meters behind. For a long time he just walked. It wasn't so hard. The crenellated ice surface crunched under his brown boots. The sun had softened the top layer, despite the cool wind. The surface was too bright to see properly, even with sunglasses. The ice joggled as he walked and glowed blackly. The ridges to left and right began their drop. He came out into Concordia Platz. He could see up glaciers into other high canyons, as if up ice fingers of a hand held up to the sun. The wrist ran down to the south, the grosser Alitschgletscher. He was standing in the white palm offered to the sun next to a lifeline of rubble. The ice out here was pitted and gnarly and bluish in tone. A wind picked at him and swirled through his heart. He turned around slowly, like a little planet, like a top about to fall, trying to take it in, to face it. So big, so bright, so windy and vast, so crushingly heavy. The sheer mass of the white world. And yet with a kind of darkness behind it, as of space's vacuum, there visible behind the sky. He took off his sunglasses to see what it really looked like, and the glare was so immediate and violent that he had to close his eyes to cover his face in the crook of his arm. Still, great white bars pulsed in his vision, and even the afterimage hurt in its blinding intensity. "Wow!" he shouted, and laughed, determined to try it again as soon as the afterimages lessened, but before his pupils had again expanded. So he did, but the second attempt was as bad as the first. "How dare you try to look on me as I really am?" the world shouted silently. "My God!" with feeling. "Kowow!" He put his sunglasses back on his closed eyes, looked out through the bounding afterimages. Gradually, the primeval landscape of ice and rock restabilized out of the pulsing bars of black and white and neon green. The white and the green. And this was the white. The blank world of the inanimate universe. This place had precisely the same import as the primal Martian landscape. Just as big as it was on Mars. Yes, and even bigger, because of the distant horizons and the crushing gravity, and steeper, and whiter, and windier. Ka! It pierced so chill through his parka, even windier, even colder. Ah, God, like a wind lancing through his heart. The sudden knowledge that Earth was so vast that in its variety it had regions that even outmarsed Mars itself, that, among all the ways that it was greater even at being Martian. He was brought still by this thought. He only stood and stared, tried to face it. The wind died for the moment. The world, too, was still. No movement. No sound. When he noticed the silence, he began paying attention to it, listening for something, hearing nothing, so that the silence itself somehow became more and more palpable. It was unlike anything he had ever heard before. He thought about it. On Mars he had always been in tents or in suits, always in machinery except for during the rare walks on the surface he had made in recent years. But then there had always been the wind or machines nearby, or he simply hadn't noticed. Now there was only the great silence, the silence of the universe itself. No dream could imagine it. And then he began to hear sounds again, the blood in his ears, his breath in his nose, the quiet whir of his thinking. It seemed to have a sound. His own support system this time, his body with its organic pumps and ventilators and generators. The mechanisms were all still there, provided inside him, making their noises. But now he was free of anything more. In a great silence where he could actually hear himself quite well, just himself on this world alone, a free body standing on its mother earth, free in the rock and ice where it had all begun. Mother Earth, he thought of Hiroko, and this time without the tearing grief that he had felt in Trinidad. When he returned to Mars, he could live like this. He could walk out in the silence a free being, live outdoors in the wind, in something like this pure, vast, lifeless whiteness, with something like this dark, blue dome overhead, the blue, a visible exhalation of life itself. Oxygen, life's own color. Up there, doming the whiteness. A sign, somehow. The white and the green, except here the green was blue. With shadows. Among the faint, lingering afterimages lay long shadows running from the west. He was a long way from Jungfraujoch, and considerably lower as well. He turned and began hiking up the Jungfrau fern. In the distance, up the trail, his two companions nodded and turned uphill themselves, hiking fast. Soon enough, they were in the shadow of the ridge to the west, the sun now out of sight for good on this day, and the wind swirling over his back, helping on. Cold, indeed. But it was his kind of temperature, after all, and his kind of air, just a nice touch of extra thickness to it. And so, despite the weight inside him, he began to trudge on up the crunchy hard pack in a little jog, leaning into it, feeling his thigh muscles respond to the challenge, fall into their old Lungompa rhythm, with his lungs pumping hard, and his heart as well, to handle the extra weight. But he was strong, strong, and this was one of Earth's little high regions of Marsness, and so he crunched up the fern, feeling stronger by the minute, also appalled, exhilarated, awed. It was a most astonishing planet that could have so much of the white and so much of the green as well, its orbit so exquisitely situated that at sea level the green burst out, and at 3,000 meters the white blanketed it utterly. The natural zone of life, just that 3,000 meters wide, more or less. And Earth rolled right in the middle of that filmy bubble biosphere, in the right few 1,000 meters out of an orbit 150 million kilometers wide. It was too lucky to be believed. His skin began to tingle with the effort. He was warm all over, even his toes. Beginning to sweat. The cold air was deliciously invigorating. He felt he was in a pace that he could sustain for hours, but alas, he wouldn't need to. Ahead and a bit above lay the snow staircase with its rope and stanchion railing. His guides were making good time ahead of him, hurrying up the final slope. Soon he too would be there in the little train station space station. These Swiss, what they thought to build. To be able to visit the stupendous Concordia plots on a day trip from the nation's capital. No wonder they were so sympathetic to Mars. They were Earth's closest thing to Martians, truly. Builders, terraformers, inhabitants of the thin cold air. so he was feeling very benevolent toward them when he stepped onto the terrace and then burst into the station where he began immediately steaming. And when he walked over to his group of escorts and the other passengers who were waiting next to the little train, he was beaming so completely, he was so high, that the impatient frowns of the group, he saw that they had been kept waiting, cracked, and they looked at each other and laughed, shaking their heads as if to say to each other, "What can you do?" You could only grin and let it happen. They had all been young in the high Alps for the first time, one sunny summer day, and had felt that same enthusiasm. They remembered what it was like. And so they shook his hand, they embraced him, they led him onto the little train and got going, for no matter the event, it wasn't good to keep a train waiting. And once underway, they remarked on his hot hands and face and asked him where he had gone, and told him how many kilometers that was and how many vertical meters. They passed him a little hip flask of schnapps. And then, as the train went by the little side tunnel that ran out onto the north face of the Eiger, they told him the story of the failed rescue attempt of the doomed Nazi climbers, excited, moved, that he was so impressed. And after that they settled into the lit compartments of the train, squealing down through its rough granite tunnel. Nergal stood at the end of one car, looking out at the dynamited rock as it flashed past, and then as they burst back into sunlight, up at the looming wall of the Eiger overhead. A passenger walked by him on the way to the next car, then stopped and stared. "Amazing to see you here, I must say." He had a British accent of some kind. "I just ran into your mother last week." Confused, Nergal said, "My mother?" "Yes, Hiroko Ai. Isn't that right? She was in England, working with people at the mouth of the Thames. I saw her on my way here. Quite a coincidence running into you, too, I must say. It makes me think I'll start seeing little red men any second now." The man laughed at the thought, began to move on into the next car. "Hey," Nergal called, "wait." But the man only paused. "No, no," he said over his shoulder. "Didn't want to intrude, all I know anyhow. You'll have to look her up, in Sheerness, perhaps." And then the train was squealing into the station at Kleinscheidegg, and the man hopped out an opening door in the next car, and as Nergal went to follow him, other people got in the way, and his escorts came to explain to him that he needed to descend to Grindelwald immediately if he wanted to get home that night. Nergal couldn't deny them. But looking out the window as they rolled out of the station, he saw the British man who had spoken to him walking briskly down a trail into the dusky valley below. He landed at a big airport in southern England and was driven north and east to a town the escorts called Faversham, beyond which the roads and bridges were flooded. He had arranged to come unannounced, and his escort here was a police team that reminded him more of UNTA security units back home than of his Swiss escort. 8 men and 2 women, silent, staring, full of themselves. When they had heard what he wanted to do, they had wanted to hunt for Hiroko by bringing people in to ask about her. Nergal was sure that would put her in hiding, and he insisted on going out without fanfare to look for her. Eventually, he convinced them. They drove in a gray dawn down to a new seafront right there among buildings. In some places there were lines of stacked sandbags between soggy walls, in other places just wet streets running off under dark water that spread for as far as he could see. Some planks were thrown here and there over mud and puddles. Then on the far side of one line of sandbags was brown water without any buildings beyond, and a number of rowboats tied to a grill covering a window half awash in dirty foam. Nergal followed one of the escorts into one big rowboat and greeted a wiry, red-faced man wearing a dirty cap pulled low over his forehead. A kind of water policeman, apparently. The man shook his hand limply, and then they were off, rowing over opaque water, followed by 3 more boats containing the rest of Nergal's worried-looking guards. Nergal's oarsman said something, and Nergal had to ask him to repeat it. It was as if the man only had half his tongue. "Is that Cockney, your dialect?"
"Cockney,"
the man laughed. Nergal laughed too, shrugged. It was a word he remembered from a book. He didn't know what it meant, really. He had heard 1,000 different kinds of English before, but this was the real thing, presumably, and he could hardly understand it. The man spoke more slowly, which didn't help. He was describing the neighborhood they were rowing away from, pointing. The buildings were inundated nearly to their roof lines.
"Brent's,"
he said several times, pointing with his oar tips. They came to a floating dock tied to what looked like a highway sign saying O-A-R-E. Several larger boats were tied to the dock or swinging from anchor ropes nearby. The water policeman rowed to one of these boats and indicated the metal ladder welded to its rusty side.
"Go on."
Nergal climbed the side of the boat. On the deck stood a man so short he had to reach up to shake Nergal's hand, which he did with a crushing grip.
"So you're a Martian,"
he said in a voice that lilted like the oarsman's, but was somehow much easier to understand.
"Welcome aboard our research vessel. Come to hunt for the old Asian lady, I hear."
"Yes," Nergal said, his pulse quickening. "She's Japanese."
"Hmm,"
the man frowned.
"I only saw her once, but I would have said she was Asian. Bangladeshi, maybe. They're everywhere since the flood. But who can tell, eh?"
Four of Nergal's escorts climbed aboard, and the boat's owner pushed a button that started an engine, then spun the wheel in the wheelhouse and watched forward closely as the boat's rear pushed down in the water and they vibrated, then moved away from the drowned line of buildings. It was overcast. The clouds very low, sea and sky both a brownish gray.
"We'll go out over the wharf,"
the little captain said. Nergal nodded. "What's your name?"
"Bly's the name. B-L-Y.
"I'm Nergal," the man nodded once. "So this used to be the docks?" Nergal asked.
"This was Faversham, out here with the marshes. Am, Magdon. It was mostly marsh, all the way to the Isle of Sheppey. The swale, this was. More fen than flow, if you know what I mean. Now you get out here on a windy day, and it's like the North Sea itself. And Sheppey is no more than that hill you see out there. A proper island now."
"And that's where you saw..." He didn't know what to call her.
"Your Asian grandma came in on the ferry from Vlissingen to Sheerness, other side of that island. Sheerness and Minster have the Thames for streets these days. And at high tide, they have it for their roofs, too. We're over Magdon Marsh now. We'll go out around Shell Ness. The swale's too clotted."
The mud-colored water around them sloshed this way and that. It was lined by long, curving trails of yellowing foam. On the horizon, the water grayed. Bly spun the wheel, and they slapped over short, steep waves. The boat rocked, and in its entirety moved up and down, up and down. Nergal had never been in one before. Gray clouds hung over them. There was only a wedge of air between the cloud bottoms and the choppy water. The boat jostled this way and that, bobbing cork-like, a liquid world.
"It's a lot shorter around than it used to be,"
Captain Bly said from the wheel.
"If the water were clearer, you could see Say's Court underneath us."
"How deep is it?" Nergal asked.
"Depends on the tide. This old island was about an inch above sea level before the flood. So however much sea level has gone up, that's how deep it is. What are they saying now? 25 feet? More than this old girl needs, that's sure. She's got a very shallow draft."
He spun the wheel left, and the swells hit the boat from the side so that it rolled in quick, uneven jerks. He pointed at one gauge.
"There, 5 meters. Hearty marsh. See that potato patch? The rough water there? They'll come up at mid-tide. Looks like a drowned giant buried in the mud.
What's the tide now?
Near full. It'll turn in half an hour.
It's hard to believe Luna can pull the ocean around that much.
What? You don't believe in gravity?
Oh, I believe in it. It's crushing me right now. It's just hard to believe something so far away has that much pull.
Hmm,
the captain said, looking out into a bank of mist blocking the view ahead.
I'll tell you what's hard to believe. It's hard to believe that a bunch of icebergs can displace so much water that all the oceans of the world have gone up this far.
That is hard to believe.
It's amazing, it is. But the proof's right here floating us. Ah, the mist has arrived.
Do you get more bad weather than you used to? The captain laughed.
That'd be comparing absolutes, I'd say.
The mist blew past them in wet long veils, and the choppy waves smoked and hissed. It was dim. Suddenly Nergal felt happy despite the unease in his stomach during the deceleration at the bottom of every wave trough. He was boating on a water world, and the light was at a tolerable level at last. He could stop squinting for the first time since he had arrived on Earth. The captain spun his big wheel again, and they ran with the waves directly behind them, northwest, into the mouth of the Thames. Off to their left, a brownish-green ridge emerged wetly out of the greenish-brown water, buildings crowding its slope.
That's Minster, or what's left of it. It was the only high ground on the island. Sheerness is over there. You can see where the water's all shattered over it.
Under the low ceiling of streaming mist, Nergal saw what looked like a reef of foaming white water sloshing in every direction at once, black under the white foam. That's Sheerness?
Yeah.
Did they all move to Minster?
Or somewhere. Most of them. There's some very stubborn people in Sheerness.
Then the captain was absorbed in bringing the boat in through the drowned seafront of Minster. Where the line of rooftops emerged from the waves, a large building had had its roof and sea-facing wall removed, and now it functioned as a little marina, its three remaining walls sheltering a patch of water, and the upper floors at the back serving as dock. Three other fishing boats were moored there, and as they coasted in, some men on them looked up and waved.
"Who's this?" one of them said as Bligh nosed his boat into the dock. "One of the Martians. We're trying to find the Asian lady who was helping in Sheerness the other week. Have you seen her?"
"Not lately.
Couple of months, actually. I heard she crossed to South End. They'll know down in the sub."
Bligh nodded.
"Do you want to see Minster?" he said to Nergal.
Nergal frowned. "I'd rather see the people who might know where she is."
"Yeah."
Bligh backed the boat out of the gap, turned it around. Nergal looked in at boarded windows, stained plaster, the shelves of an office wall, some notes tacked to a beam. As they motored over the drowned portion of Minster, Bligh picked up a radio microphone on a corkscrewed cord and punched buttons. He had a number of short conversations, very hard for Nergal to follow.
"Ah, Jack,"
and the like, with all the answers emerging from explosive static.
"We'll try Sheerness, then. Tide's right."
And so they motored right into the white water and foam sloshing over the submerged town, following streets very slowly. In the center of the foam, the water was calmer. Chimneys and telephone poles stuck out of the gray liquid, and Nergal caught occasional glimpses of the houses and buildings below, but the water was so foamy on top and so murky below that very little was visible. The slope of a roof, a glimpse down into a street, the blind window of a house. On the far side of the town was a floating dock anchored to a concrete pillar sticking out of the surf.
"This is the old ferry dock. They cut off one section and floated it, and now they've pumped out the ferry offices down below and reoccupied them."
"Reoccupied them?"
"You'll see."
Bligh hopped from the rocking gunwale to the dock and held out a hand to help Nergal across. Nevertheless, Nergal crashed to one knee when he hit.
"Come on, Spider-Man! Down we go!"
The concrete pillar anchoring the dock stood chest high. It turned out to be hollow, and a metal ladder had been bolted down its inner side. Electric bulbs hung from sockets on a rubber-coated wire, twisted around one post of the ladder. The concrete cylinder ended some 3 meters down, but the ladder continued down into a big chamber, warm, humid, fishy, and humming with the noise of several generators in another room or building. The building's walls, the floor, the ceilings, and windows were all covered by what appeared to be a sheet of clear plastic. They were inside a bubble of some kind of clear material. Outside the windows was water, murky and brown, bubbling like dishwater in a sink. Nergal's face no doubt revealed his surprise. Bly, smiling briefly at the sight, said,
"It was a good strong building. Though what you might call sheetrock is something like the tent fabrics you use on Mars, only it hardens. People have been reoccupying quite a few buildings like this, if they're the right size and depth. Set a tube, and poof, it's like blowing glass. So a lot of Sheerness folk are moving back out here and sailing off the dock or off their roof. Tide people, we call them. They figure it's better than begging for charity in England, eh?"
"What do they do for work?"
"Fish, like they always have, and salvage. Hey, Karna? Here's my Martian. Say hello. He's short where he comes from, eh? Call him Spider-Man."
"But it's Nergal, ain't it? I'll be fucked if I call Nergal Spider-Man when I got him visiting in me home."
And the man, black-haired and dark-skinned, an Asian in appearance if not accent, shook Nergal's right hand gently.
This ends Side 2 of Cassette 6 of Blue Mars. Please fast forward to the end before loading Cassette 7.